Economic Development Committee to order. And I'm going to open an informational meeting this morning on economic growth and the baby boom generation. And we're fortunate to have with us this morning Graham Slater. If you would, please. Welcome to our committee.
Representing the baby boom generation.
Thank you for coming out early this morning.
You're welcome. I've been here a while.
We're fortunate to have you, Graham.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Graham Slater with the Employment Department's Workforce and Economic Research Division. I've been there quite a few years, which is why some people know me fairly well from over the years. Some of you are new, so let me just introduce by saying that my group, the Employment Department's Research Division, we're the ones that put out a lot of the employment workforce information that you all use, probably don't think about that much, the unemployment rates, you know, which industries are growing in your areas, what are wages doing in your areas. We're the ones that put all that kind of thing out, including, which is what we'll talk about this morning, projections, not just for Oregon as a state, which is where I'll focus most of my time this morning, but also projections for all of the 15 workforce regions across the state. So one of the things that Oregon has a long history of, unlike some states, is really producing data at the county level where we can, and then at the workforce region level at a minimum. So I will briefly mention some comparisons this morning of the different trends across different regions, some obviously growing more quickly than others. So today, again, invited to share these brand new, as of December, 10-year projections. This is something we do every 2 years, and we always kind of leapfrog forward 10 years. The primary purpose here, and I want to make a very important point, the primary purpose is not to predict when the next recession is coming. Okay, that's Tom Petowski's job, and bless him for trying. Okay, you're all very familiar with that. Tom's staff and my staff work very closely together, but the short-term projections for the state and, of course, the implications for money, that's Tom's thing. What we're looking at is the long-term projections, particularly in terms of career information. That's how this long-term occupational thing really got started decades ago, trying to give decent information to young people or adults who are retraining to say, what are some of the occupations that you might think about training for, and what are some of the ones that maybe that's not a good use of your time or a good use of our state resources in terms of training. So we'll go straight to the PowerPoint. And hopefully, I did give you handouts there, or you can just follow along up here with me. And of course, I know you'll ask questions if you have any. So, first of all, what we do is start out with the industry projections. They're kind of the important stepping stone to get to the occupations. And what you can see up on the slide is the history series, the light blue there, showing employment in Oregon over about 40 or 50 years. Obviously, one of the things you notice right away is that we're a growing state. Probably not new information to most of you. And as we look out over the next 10 years, we're predicting about a 14% growth rate. Now, you could say, is that good or bad? Well, it's on the slow side of where Oregon has been historically. Now, part of that is we're a bigger state, so the bigger you get, the harder it is to have that percent rate. If you're a very tiny county in Oregon, having 14% employment growth may mean you only added 100 jobs. As the state continues to expand, maintaining that growth gets a little harder. But also, the very bottom bullet there on the right, we're not seeing any major, what some call, engine of growth that would really spur us to amazing growth as opposed to just steady growth. Back in the 70s, we had a booming lumber and wood products industry, a long time ago, and a booming construction industry, and we had very strong growth rates. In the 90s, somewhat unexpected to most people, we had that huge electronics, computer, semiconductor boom. But you all know what happened then when we got to around 2000, 2002, when a lot of those jobs that we gained so rapidly, they suddenly disappeared during the recession, and most of them have not come back. So we're not seeing anything that we can really nail that says, yes, there's something that will add 40,000 jobs that would really just, you know, boost us beyond what we would call this steady kind of growth. It is consistent with Tom Petowski's forecast. He doesn't go out 10 years as far as we do, but he does go out a good number of years. And again, we work closely with his staff. They're part of our discussions to make sure we're being consistent. So I would characterize it as a steady, sustainable growth. What we had in the mid-90s, everybody agreed, was not sustainable. So when it came to an end, nobody was that surprised. You just couldn't maintain that kind of growth over time. Looking at different industries, what we see is that almost all industries are going to be in that 10%+ growth rate. Let's start from the top. Education and health services. In this context, the education is private education, so the private colleges or K-12 schools, but the big player in that particular line is health services, and it's probably no surprise to most of you that health services has been growing, is growing, and is projected to grow. Part of that, of course, is the aging workforce and the aging population. With more and more of us living longer, we do need more healthcare workers, because in those last years of life, we consume an enormous amount of healthcare of different kinds. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. Professional business services also growing very strongly, and that one kind of spans a whole range of industries, including temporary help, but also including engineering firms, accounting firms, law firms. So there's kind of a lot of mix there of some high-wage jobs, a few low-wage jobs, but that whole professional service part of the economy still growing and projected to grow very quickly. The next one, I will just mention the wages here to kind of set the scene for later discussions. The next one's growing very rapidly too, leisure and hospitality. So we think of that tourism type things. Things that every one of us enjoy and want, but typically pretty low-wage jobs. So I find myself in some interesting situations sometimes where I give these types of presentations and folks really want to talk about all the high-wage jobs that will be created by Oregon's economy. And the fact is, there will also be a lot of low-wage jobs created by Oregon's economy. There's no way around that. Many of you on your way down here stop for a latte, or you will at some point. You'll go out to lunch. You know, you want to go to the beach for a week in the summer. A lot of those jobs, we value them because of the service they provide, but they're not the highest wage jobs. I think we'd all agree on that. Moving on down to the bottom, you see a couple of very different industries growing by about 1%, manufacturing and natural resources. Those industries, as you probably know, have not grown much in the last few years. And nobody really knows, to be honest, whether manufacturing will creep up a little bit in 10 years or could even slide down a little bit. These are all projections. I've joked with some of the boards I've spoken with. All these projections will be wrong. That's the nature of projecting out 10 years in the future. But our goal is to give roughly the right trends so that, you know, people training for new careers, colleges planning new programs of training, are at least getting it mostly right. And on this manufacturing one, we are a state that still seems to be holding our own in manufacturing. We still are projecting some growth, albeit pretty small. I was just glancing at the national projections before I came here, just to refresh my mind, and manufacturing nationally is projected to go down. So we're quite different to a lot of states in the nation. Now, this very small growth in manufacturing really is not the take-home message, and I want to get to that take-home message a few slides from now when we talk not just about growth but also about retirements.
Graham, if you would, just for a moment, please, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Witt. So that I'm not fixated on this question, I've got in my mind the full time. If I could ask you to maybe frame the statistics with the goals of the Oregon Business Plan and the work of Bob Repine and economic development in natural resources and renewable energy and those sectors that seem to have some attractive goals for employment, new business, manufacturing, good-paying jobs. And unless I'm missing something, I don't really see the story that we heard yesterday reflected here. And so I'm just wondering how... Am I missing something?
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, if you're referring to plans like the did you talk about the 40-40-20 goals yesterday?
We were talking about opportunities in clean technology and energy-related sectors, those sorts of things, and the tremendous potential that we have. First, for direct industry, and secondly, for secondary and tertiary impacts as well. And the indications seem to be that the opportunity was very large, and that our economic development department was out aggressively recruiting, targeted specifically to clean tech. And trying to ramp that industry up, and it was frankly, a twofold approach. One was attracting new businesses on the one hand, but on the other also providing opportunities for existing manufacturers to ramp up their operations in support of this growing and emerging sector.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair and Representative Huffman, now to answer maybe a little bit better, I think two things would be relevant, at least two things. Number one is that these projections really kind of portray what we see as the most likely employment trends for Oregon, given what we have now, given what we know now, given the current trends that we see. We make a pretty strong point of not putting into these projections some of the things that the chair just spoke about, you know, leads that are out there right now that we wouldn't even know about anyway because they're probably confidential. But even if we knew leads that are out there, we wouldn't put in these projections. We set a pretty high threshold to say something's got to be either certain or pretty close to certain, and I'll share an example in a minute of one that will make sense to you, before we would put it in these projections. Because over the years, we've seen a lot of leads and a lot of great ideas come and go, and a few of them stick and really do turn into a major trend, and many of them don't. They're not bad ideas, they just don't turn into thousands of new jobs. The second thing I'd say, we've had a number of discussions with quite a few people about what are broadly termed as the aspirational goals. So this is really about, you know, what will Oregon look like 10 years from now if roughly current trends continue? And then there are those that strongly advocate we need to be looking at aspirational goals. We can't just accept what is today and let it continue. We've got to do something, whether it's, you know, clean technology or whether it's different kinds of training. We've got to do something to attract different kinds of businesses. That's not what these projections are about. This is kind of where we're heading based on current trends. And one thing we've offered to a couple of the different groups we've talked to is, if they can develop these aspirational goals to the point that they can turn it into the kind of data that fits with ours, we could then run our occupational trends against those goals and say, here's what we see happening, and here's what might happen if your dreams came true, so to speak. So those we met with Duncan Weiss and some others on that exact subject. So, okay? So this is really kind of what will likely be without major changes. And I'll probably refer a couple times again to some other aspects of what you said. So,
Representative Polvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment on Representative Huffman's observation, and I was thinking back to the informational hearing we had with education where they showed, and maybe somebody can elaborate, maybe Mr. Chair can elaborate on that a little bit, where they did show that the demand for job opportunities requiring degrees and the growth was really in other sectors, and I was surprised at how small the demand for in the natural resource and manufacturing sectors really were in that portrayal. So these figures sort of match that as well, which I don't know what the correlation there is. Since I missed half that meeting, unfortunately. And then the second part, I had a question for Mr. Slater in regards to this. I noticed that, you know, the construction and financial activities have good growth, and right now, as you know, we've seen a quarter of the mortgage brokers laid off, and the real estate industry is struggling, and construction is down, and the demand for wood products is down because of that slow growth in that area, and it doesn't seem to be reflected in any of these charts or figures. And maybe it is reflected, it's just perhaps that it would have been stronger otherwise. I was just wondering if you'd comment on that.
Sure, Mr. Chair and Representative Hovey. Let me go back to that earlier comment I made. We're not trying to predict those ups and downs. So when we look out, taking a long-term view of Oregon, do we think construction will be strong? Absolutely. Do we think Oregon will continue to attract a lot of people to come live here, buy houses, build houses? Absolutely. If we map these out, as my first slide did, as kind of a straight line, we know that there will be some really strong years in there, and there will be some maybe terrible years, or at least weak years. So some of those industries, yeah, we're starting this 10-year, because it's 06 to 16, we're starting this 10-year phase with a pretty slow couple of years, no doubt. But when you get out to 2011, 2013, by the time you get to 2016, will we look back on these 10 years and say, boy, that was a terrible time for construction. We just never recovered from the 07 slide? Probably not. Not in a state like Oregon. We're probably going to look back and say construction maybe had a couple of kind of sluggish years, and then it bounded back. Certainly the history of construction these last 10 or 15 years has been amazingly strong growth, not just residential, but across all kinds of construction. And I think long term we'll see it continue. We're just in a tough spot right now. And again, these are looking at the long term. That's the whole point of them. Okay.
I think, too, it might also be fair, Graham, and correct me if I'm wrong, but even in some of our relatively low, slow or no growth industries, that there are still opportunities within those industries to get some very, very good, very high-skilled, very high-paying jobs, even though it may not be a growth center.
Right, Mr. Chair, you're about six slides ahead.
Oh, okay.
And that is one of the most important points. Again, this graph shows you the actual numbers of employees. This graph does not tell you very much at all worthwhile about the need for workers, because that's that other side of it with the replacements, retirements. So we will definitely get to there, because that's really more important. Okay? All right. Just to give you a couple of examples below those very broad industries, we make these projections at a very detailed industry level. What you're seeing, obviously, is a summation, or we would be here all day. One of the interesting things is that all the components of health services make it into this list of the industries adding most jobs. And I just throw that out. You know, I think your committee and many others have heard plenty in the last few years about health services, and not just the need for nurses, but also for many other healthcare professionals across Oregon. And we see that pretty much every set of projections I've been part of with the employment department, you see health services coming out towards the top. We also see some industries that we do believe are going to lose jobs. And so here's kind of the worst case downside. We see wood products manufacturing losing a couple thousand. Now, to put that in perspective, if you go back to the 70s, wood products was about 80,000 and dropped to about 40,000 in a 3 or 4 year period. We've had really not much growth since then. We've had parts of the industry that have done pretty well, parts that haven't. So the loss of another 1,000 to 2,000 in 10 years is certainly not catastrophic kind of news. It's pretty much what we're used to in Oregon. But nonetheless, it's one of the few industries that really is showing that kind of decline. The computer and electronics is a surprise to some because, again, we're so used to thinking high-tech must be good, high-tech grows, electronics. And since the downturn in the early 2000s, when we had the recession, we haven't seen the computer electronics, particularly semiconductor, bouncing back in Oregon. And in fact, I think most people kind of assume it won't at this point, certainly not back to where it was. And we were very careful on this one, that it's very consistent with Tom Potowski's forecast. And he, of course, has a bunch of advisors, the Governor's Council, who can really dig into some of these industries and give very careful advice. Federal government has been shrinking for a number of years across the board, except for Homeland Security and defense, but also particularly in natural resources. So when in Oregon, we don't have much defense, if any, in federal government. We do have some Homeland Security, airports and so on, but a lot of what we have is the forests and the national park, the one park we have, and we've seen declines in those. And this is not a huge decline, 1,000 over 10 years, but it is kind of symptomatic of the trend that we see. The other two are very small and probably not worth specific mention. So let's turn to the regions. And this is where, again, we make projections for all 15 regions. So if you're working with a community college in Eastern Oregon or a high school in Bend, you don't have to just give your students information on what's going on statewide. It may not be that relevant to them if they want to stay in the area. We produce this. All of the information I'm sharing with you today could be adapted for any one of the 15 workforce regions. A couple of things to highlight on these regional breakouts. Number one, Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson, so that's Bend, Lapine, Madras, that whole area, Redmond and Sisters, is projected to be the fastest growing, and that is probably consistent with every projection of the last 10 or 15 years. It's always among the top two fastest growing anyway. And then an interesting one bounces into the second spot, and it's Region 9, which is the Hood River, the Dalles area. And the real reason that that one bounces so high is the likelihood, and you remember what I said about the high threshold, the likelihood of the casino going in up there. And when we made these projections, it was looking pretty likely. You know, the governor had supported it, everybody was pretty positive, and we made a conscious decision to include that casino. Well, here we are, months later, not much activity, certainly some question marks. So if that casino were not to happen, then really that region would just drop into the rest of the pack. There's no other reason it's number two on the list. It's a good, solid region. It's growing decently, but adding 1,000 or 1,500 or even 2,000 jobs obviously surges it towards the top of the pack. So that's kind of an understanding of what's going on there. Towards the bottom, Coos Curry has consistently been among the slowest. The only bright spot here is that I can remember projections that we did where Coos Curry was in the 6 and 7% growth range. So 10 isn't significantly fast, but it is at least an improvement. And one important thing to note here is that every region in Oregon is projected to grow. That's a positive thing. Again, there are certainly rural areas in many states where the projection is not for growth at all, where the projection is that 10 years from now there will be fewer jobs than there are today. So we are fortunate in that regard in Oregon. Now I'd like to shift over to occupations, because what we do is make all of these projections by industry, and then because we survey Oregon businesses, we can actually match our occupational surveys with the industry projections, and we know, for example, that hospitals have a certain number of nurses and doctors and receptionists and janitors, and then we can project out to see, well, what would the impact be on these occupational trends? And for students and adults and colleges planning training, this is where it gets interesting, because now we're talking about actual jobs that we need to train for, or actual jobs that could be a career. And so what we see on the occupational trends is that the first two there, adding the most jobs, service and office and administrative support, are not particularly high-wage jobs. And once again, that's one of those that comes in and says, you know, we will produce a lot of medium to lower-wage jobs in addition to, yes, there will be some high-wage ones, and you see that in the third and fourth, professional and healthcare, certainly tend towards higher wage. Look for a second about two-thirds down the page and find production there, fourth from the bottom. And this links directly with the manufacturing graph we saw earlier, where the initial message or the initial thought would be, boy, we don't need many manufacturing workers and we don't need many production workers. Now, that's the initial thought. That is not the final thought. I don't want you to leave with that. But that's what you could certainly get from looking at these graphs. I do want to mention on the occupations, there are about 700 of the 700 occupations that we estimate for, about 40 we predict will actually decline in numbers over the 10 years. But only, with the exception of only five of them, we will still need new workers. Okay, and that comes into this huge baby boom retirement issue that really is one of the biggest themes that I think we'll talk about. We'll get there in just a second. One of the themes that I guess I like to mention is that things change slowly. When we talk about some of the things that Representative Huffman mentioned earlier, you know, clean energy, sustainability, those kind of things, they will have maybe a significant impact over time, but the overall economy, 1.7 million jobs, it changes slowly. So if you added a few jobs in some new and growing and emerging and really neat industry, you may add 500 jobs, you may even add 5,000, but out of 1.7 million, it won't change some of the trends that much. What this graph shows is that most of those broad occupational areas really don't change in the percent that they make up of the whole economy. They don't change hardly at all over the 10 years. So this is not some radical change where we suddenly don't need production workers anymore, but we need five times as many healthcare workers as we used to need. And sometimes you can kind of read that, it's portrayed almost that dramatically. There's a crisis here, all the production jobs are gone, everybody has to train to be a healthcare worker. Well, we do need more healthcare workers, and there is slow growth in production, but it's not as dramatic as it's sometimes made to be. The two in green there, those are industries where definitely they will, or occupations, where they will make up more of the economy 10 years from now than they do today. Healthcare makes up about 6.5% of all the jobs today. It'll be a little over 7% 10 years from now. Production work makes up 7.6% today. It'll be about 7% 10 years from now. So there are some changes, but they happen fairly slowly. Okay, probably the two most important graphs of the whole morning coming up here. This one talks about the vacancies, the jobs that we will need to fill. And instead of just looking at those growth openings, which is what we've been focused on so far, we now add in our estimates of how many replacement openings we'll need to fill. And replacements can be any reason why somebody leaves an occupation permanently. So in the case of a McDonald's job, a lot of people leave those occupations permanently because they didn't intend to stay there their whole career anyway. So they could have high replacement rates. But across most occupations, the big driver for replacement is retirement. And that's what we're going to talk about here. Particularly if we use production, remember I drew your attention to it earlier, had a very small number of growth openings, but production work has really quite a significant number of replacement openings. And that's because a lot of people in manufacturing are in their 50s. The average age in quite a few industries is mid to high 40s, so that means a lot of the workers are well into their 50s. And what I've said to a number of workforce-related groups is, you know, if Oregon does lose some of those manufacturing companies because of highways or taxes or a number of other things that aren't workforce-related, well, those are things that you all have to worry about. But as far as, you know, what could I do or what can my data do, probably not a lot. But if Oregon loses manufacturing companies that say, we love being here, the roads are great, the airport's great, taxes are great, we simply cannot find trained workers, then that really is on our shoulders as the workforce system. And that's the way I've kind of presented this graph to a lot of audiences in the last many years, these new numbers in the last few months. So we really have a challenge not to focus only on this growth of production, which is relatively slow, but to get the word out to our high school kids and many others that manufacturing in Oregon is predicted to have a future, but it will only have a future if we can find skilled workers. And in other studies that we've done, manufacturing jobs tend to pay pretty well, and it's one of the best industries as far as providing actual benefits, healthcare and retirement and vacations and so on. So it really has a lot of attractive things that can be communicated. And I think a lot of people think of it, you know, old-style manufacturing, not a great job, no future, manufacturing going down in the nation. We hear that all the time. So this is a little different picture.
Representative Holby.
Don't mean to slow this down, Mr. Chair, but I kind of one of those burning questions, I suppose. Looking at your graph and recognizing that we have a huge amount of training to do, to have that skilled workforce, the graph doesn't really tell me, do we have the population currently, you know, with the amount of children in our state growing up that to fill all those needs, or are we going to be relying on migration into the state to fill these job slots?
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, I think both are true. We did some looking last year, and I don't have the numbers memorized anymore, but we did some pretty close looks at that whole baby boom, you know, just are there enough bodies in the state, basically. Mm. And our belief is yes. You know, so again, some people portray that as much more of a crisis than we see. We think we already have a big labor shortage of skilled workers right now. You don't have to wait 10 years to see that. But overall, most of the numbers, we think we do have enough bodies. However, we're going to have more in-migration. That is just Oregon's history. There's no way that I could see that we would stop having in-migration to Oregon because it's a great place. Lots of people come here for all kinds of reasons, jobs being just one of them, not necessarily the main one even. I do think we could have some problems in some of the more rural areas in terms of do we have enough bodies, because the trend is that, you know, that some of the young people will continue to leave those rural areas. So when you look at some rural and pretty expensive areas, maybe Central Oregon or the coast, that gets a little tough for young workers, particularly if they're new in the labor force, not making that much money. Housing costs are high, childcare is not that available. Well, we did some studies, particularly in Lincoln County, and that's a problem. But for Oregon as a whole, I think we've got plenty of people, and we will continue getting more people. The training will be one of the issues. Okay. Turning that occupational replacement opening graph kind of back on its head and just jumping back to industries for a second, here's the change that happens with manufacturing. The green, obviously, is the growth openings, and you remember where we started, manufacturing with very slow 1% growth. But when we add in all of those replacement openings, again, manufacturing actually comes right up into the middle of the pack and says, if we're serious about maintaining our manufacturing, we've got to be talking to young people and adults and providing the right training for them to be qualified for all of these thousands of jobs that will be created. either because of the little bit of growth or because of the large amount of retirements that will be taking place. Back to the theme of things change slowly. People always ask me, so are we moving towards a more high-wage economy, high-wage jobs? And again, it just changes almost dramatically slowly, if you can put those two words together. The percent of the economy or the percent of the total jobs that will be high wage, and in this context we're talking 45,000 or more, you can kind of pick a number, literally remains unchanged over the 10 years. And we didn't fix those numbers. That was, you know, we do our numbers and see where they end up. It just shows how slowly things change. We do see just fractional changes on the low and medium wage, but statistically, 10 years out projections, really, there's nothing here that you could say is a noteworthy trend at all, except not much changes. Now I'd like to go into a series of discussions on the education requirements, and those also very much tie into discussions I've been part of, and you may have been, back to those aspirational goals. You know, do we have a highly enough trained workforce, or will we have, so that companies will come here and provide those kind of high-wage jobs that we all want? And also, are those jobs of the future that we're currently producing, do they demand high levels of education? And you hear this both ways. What we find startles a few people, and that is that if you look at all the jobs that will be created, and you look at the minimum education requirement, so that's the education requirement that maybe you'd find in a labor shortage era when everything's strong and employers are desperate. And if you think about the retirements that are coming towards us, that could be what we face for a number of years. Because if there are a lot of retirements, a lot of employers, so we hear, will be desperate. So this minimum education requirement means you can basically do the job, you're going to get an interview, and you may be the best they can get because you are basically qualified. And if we look at that, what we see is that for all the openings, growth and replacement, only about one-fourth require post-secondary education. Only about one-fourth, okay? I see the look of surprise there, which I'm used to, because you hear so much about, in this new economy, all the jobs will require more education. And now don't kind of take off on this graph without letting me finish several more, because there's more to the story. But minimum requirement for the jobs that we see coming, based on the current trends, about one-fourth would require post-secondary. And then if we want these people to be actually competitive, so turn it around and say we're in kind of a slowdown and employers can be picky. Or from an investment point of view, say employers can actually get the kind of workers they'd really like. That's what we're talking about when we talk about being competitive for jobs. And there we get up to about half. Half of the jobs, roughly, will require post-secondary or more. So you can see we've dramatically changed it just by saying, are we only going to set our goal for the minimum qualified, or do we want employees that will really be very good and useful and employers will be pleased with them? We're going to add another criteria to that in a second, which would be to say, what if we then look at just the high-wage jobs as opposed to all the jobs?
Representative Foley.
Oh, thank you. And you just touched on, I was just noticing on your chart, who picks the definition of high wage being at more than 45,000 and medium wage 30 to 45 and low wage less than 30?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, we do. And you'd probably like to know how, right?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, based, you know, $45,000, I guess, doesn't exactly seem like a high wage, I suppose, if you're trying to make ends meet and make a house payment and things like that. Doesn't seem like, you know, that's somebody that's driving around in a Lexus and, you know, living the high life. And so I'm just curious about that definition.
Right.
It seems kind of, those scales seem kind of arbitrarily low to me.
Well, they're certainly arbitrary, and I said that when I put the graph up there. I mean, there is a methodology behind it, but they are arbitrary. If you ask a number of people, what do you think is a high wage? If I asked you, I'd probably get five different answers. The way that we've ended up, we've done it a number of ways over the year. The way that we ended up the last few years is that we look at the average wage for all of the jobs, and then we kind of look for $5,000 increments either side of that, and we start trying to... I think we went 10% either side and then found the $5,000, because we don't want to say high wage is 43,912. You know, people glaze over. So we kind of look for roundish numbers that just make sense. You know, if you want to draw it at 60,000, for some of my staff, not for me, it would be a matter of moments to redraw the graph using the data we have to say, here's what it looks like for 60,000 or 90,000. So, okay, go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair, follow up. I just think that when we're putting that sort of information out that, 30% of our jobs are high-wage jobs based on that is really kind of misleading. From my perspective, maybe others have on this panel have a different point of view, but to say that 30% of Oregon's jobs are high wage jobs based on a model that says $45,000 is a high wage, that's just not computing with me. I'd like to put that out to a vote of the people and see if they think $45,000 is a high wage. I just think that's I appreciate your admitting that it's arbitrary by definition, but I'm just having a hard time swallowing that one.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, I respect your opinion, and again, we could draw the graph based on anything. What we always do is say right on the graph what the definition is so that people can look at it and say, that doesn't ring true to me. So we're not just saying high wage with no definition, but...
Right. I appreciate that.
Again, we've done it in fifths at times, or we've done it in $10,000 increments at times.
Maybe I'll follow up with what I think are the divisions, and you can do another graph for me.
I'd be happy to.
Okay.
Yeah, seriously, no problem at all.
Representative Holby, we appreciate your advocacy for high-wage jobs.
Well, remember, the higher you set the level, the smaller the percent will be, though. So.
Yeah. Well, I just want to accurate to perceptions of the world, So.
Well, I am going to move on into a high-demand, high-wage discussion, which you might like even less. but it was a discussion that also came to this committee last year, so I don't know if you were on the committee, Representative Holby. So let me just kind of recapture where we were in that flow of discussion. About one-fourth of the jobs required post-secondary education. For all the jobs, minimum requirement. About half of them require post-secondary. For all the jobs, competitive, to be really good at the jobs and to compete in interviews. And I want to transition now to stop talking about all of the jobs and to start talking about just this group called the high-demand, high-wage jobs. This includes about 222 occupations out of the 700 or so that are the total, and it accounts for about 266,000 of all of the openings. Remember earlier we saw the slide that said there's 250,000 new openings and 450,000 replacements, so that's a 700,000 total. What I'm doing now is narrowing this down to say that we're only going to look at jobs that are in the top half in terms of wages, and the top half in terms of the number of openings. And this was something that was worked through the Oregon Workforce Investment Board last year and came to this committee as part of that skill-up fund discussion. So it was a side issue, but we did bring it to this committee. The goal in setting these levels for high demand, high wage was to give the state and to give regions some guidance as to which occupations may be more valuable for investment, for training, but also to leave enough flexibility that the state, the governor, and local policymakers, because we did these by each region too, could say, yes, I know there's a long list that I could choose from, but here's the particular industries or occupations that really make sense for our region, and therefore those are the ones we'll pick from this high-demand, high-wage list. Okay? And the little comment at the bottom, high wage, high demand lists available for every region, because we don't want the county commissioners or the workforce board in Region 1 or in Ontario or in Baker City to be tied to some list that works for the state as a whole but has almost no relevance to where they live. Mm-hmm. So that's why we do them for every region. Now, the numbers get even lower. Representative Holby's left now. Maybe he's really unhappy with his number. But, now we're down to 31,000 being the cutoff. And 31,000 is simply the middle wage. If you lined up all the jobs in Oregon from highest to lowest, you'd hit 31 right in the middle. So we're saying if a job pays more than that middle, and if a job has more openings than the middle number of openings, we will consider that to fit this definition for this purpose of high-wage, high-demand jobs, okay? Again, we can draw these lines anywhere, but this is something that was worked through about a year ago with a number of different groups and committees and boards. So once we look at the high-wage, high-demand jobs, what you see is that a much higher percentage of them require post-secondary training or work experience. You see for the minimum education, it's a little over half that are going to require that post-secondary. And then when we go to where I think we want to be in terms of being competitive, because we want to invest to be competitive, not to just meet the minimum possible standards, then we get up to where about 92% of those jobs do require post-secondary education. So you see what a different message you get from saying 25% of all the jobs, minimum qualifications, require post-secondary, to saying 92% of the high-wage, high-demand jobs, if we want to be really competitive, they require post-secondary education. So, you know, statistics are always great. People can bring all kinds of different messages to you, and I think the main reason I'm here this morning is to give you this kind of full picture of, on the one hand, this, but on the other hand, if we want to be more targeted, you see those kind of numbers. And the other thing that changes dramatically if we only look at these high-demand, high-wage lists is that some of those lower-wage jobs that used to be on the top of this graph, remember we had service was on the top and office and admin support was number two, they've shrunk way down the bottom because they don't have many jobs that are high-wage or high-demand. Certainly not high-wage and high-demand. So what comes to the top if we only look at the high-wage, high-demand jobs? What comes to the top is professional, and the next one is management. So we've kind of completely raised the requirements now in terms of education by choosing, if we choose, to focus only on those kind of jobs. I've got two or three slides that just kind of wrap this up because a lot of information exchanged hands here. And so kind of the take-home message is, I guess, three slides. We expect Oregon to grow steadily, maybe more slowly than some would like, but history has shown that we don't typically go flying out and you know, grow dramatically rapidly over the long term. We'll have some great years in there, and there will probably be some years where our projections look way too slow, but probably this year, if you were to average it out, we'll suggest our projections are way too optimistic. But over the 10 years, we think they're probably reasonable. Almost all the industries and occupations are growing. Replacement openings outnumber growth openings 2-1. So there's a huge take-home message. And very little change. Things change slowly in terms of wages and so on. And then this flow, just to repeat it one more time for you, 28% of the jobs, all the jobs, as a minimum education requirement, 28% require post-secondary education. If you move up all the jobs but looking at competitive requirements, about 53% require post-secondary. But if you look at the high-demand, high-wage jobs, jobs that will, at least to some extent, support families, jobs that are going to be in demand, we're almost sure there will be plenty of openings for those that are qualified, then 92% require the post-secondary or more education. And again, I mentioned here, last year Oregon policymakers decided to use that high demand, high wage, really as kind of the first door through which investments would go through. It didn't mean that was the last word, because there's a lot of occupations, 222 on the list. But that was the first filter. If an occupation is not highly in demand and doesn't pay a decent wage, why would we invest public resources in training for it? There may be some exceptions, there may be some reasons, but as a broad statement, that was the thinking of the board. Focusing on those occupations, though, I want to point out, if we only focus on the high-demand, high-wage occupations, it does mean that we're focusing only on about 38% of all the jobs in the economy. Nothing wrong with that. It's just important for folks like yourselves and for the workforce boards to know that by making that choice, we're saying 62% of the jobs in Oregon, we're not going to invest resources in training because they don't pay enough and they're not high demand. So it's a perfectly legitimate decision. It's just kind of good to know what that decision has as a maybe an unintended consequence. And then you've probably had numerous discussions, or you've read about some great prioritization discussions that have to go on. We don't have infinite money, so do we invest in healthcare or manufacturing, or do we look at clusters or traded sectors or some of the newer industry groups that are coming on? Technology platforms was one I believe Audrey Tice spoke to you a week or two ago with her study, which was largely based on our numbers with a lot of then additional work that she and other consultants did, and very interesting work. Was in a meeting with Audrey last week and just for the fun of it calculated the number of jobs that we'd be training for with her proposal or her report, and it ends up being 12% of all the jobs in Oregon. And that's not good or bad, that's just to say that if we decided to focus all our resources based on that report, we would be focusing resources on 12% of the jobs in the state. And they're good jobs, and they're high-wage jobs, and they're high demand, and all those things. So I'm not saying that's a bad thing by any means, just, again, trying to kind of set the broad picture. A final one that I won't spend time on, but people often ask me at some point, you know, could I really define this growth and replacement? And I think I tried to do it as I went through. But just in case you wondered it, that's the definition of the growth and replacement openings. And the bottom bullet's really important. Nowhere in this discussion have we even mentioned turnover, which dwarfs the other two. You know, we can be looking at, say, 70 or 80,000 growth and replacement openings in a year, and we will be looking at a million, or close to it, turnover openings. Turnover simply is the person that goes from McDonald's to Burger King, or from this hospital to that hospital. Was a nurse, still a nurse. Was a plumber, still a plumber. We don't have to train people for those, because the plumber already had the training, just went to be a plumber somewhere else. It's when the plumber retires that we have to train people. So that's why we focus so much on the growth and replacement, and we don't talk that much about the turnover. But we know it's there, and it's a huge number of job opportunities for the people that are trained, because every one of them is something that someone can apply for. So, Mr. Chair, that concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to take more questions if you wish, or I can be done.
Thank you very much, Graham. Yes, Vice Chair Lim.
And thank you very much for the presentation. Is this the same term you are using, production and manufacturing? Is that the same thing or something different?
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, it's something different, but it is quite associated. Production refers to a group of occupations, many of which are in the manufacturing industry. So if you think about the manufacturing industry, in a manufacturing company, you may have a lot of production workers, and that's why they're so tightly linked. But you'd have a few engineers, and you'd have some managers, and a bookkeeper, and an accountant, and a receptionist. So all of those, the managers, the accountants, they're not production workers, but they are working in the manufacturing industry. So production's looking at the people, and manufacturing's looking at the company, you know, what broad business is the company in.
Okay. One more question.
Please.
One more question or comment. As I look at the chart you presented, it seems to me our state, maybe as a country, we are going into the wrong direction, such as we are creating the healthcare jobs and many others, but we are declining or steady on the manufacturing jobs or production and jobs, which means that the many manufacturing jobs goes out of country, offshore, and we are just left, just all others. And I think we need to somehow reverse that trend. I'm not sure how to do it, but at least this is a wake-up call for our state and for our country.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, and I think you're exactly right. Oregon, I would say Oregon is a lot better off than a lot of states in that our manufacturing is at least stable, not growing rapidly. I mean, obviously we've had losses, but we've had some gains too, so the overall numbers are pretty stable. But a lot of the folks that I hear talking, they share your goal that we need to turn this around. And one of the ways to do that is to make sure that we have the skilled workforce at all levels, the manufacturers and others that will bring money and good jobs into Oregon that those people will need. But it certainly is not an easy task when every other conversation we have talks about the global economy. I mean, we can't change that global economy sitting right here, but we can certainly try to do our part to make sure that all of the components of an infrastructure, including skilled workers, are available as much as we can.
And just additional comment.
Please.
Even though we might have a lot of skilled workers available, if the manufacturing company, manufacturing jobs goes, you know, out of country, then, you know, that we are in deep trouble. And the per capita income of our country, of our state, is not growing fast enough, while other countries like Japan, Korea, and other countries, they are just catching up, you know. And it is not like 30, 40, 50 years ago, United States, that the total production was almost half of the world. Right now, we are around maybe a 20% or so. And so we need to wake up somehow. You know, this is we are having great trouble in the future.
Vice Chair Lim, I think much of what you have to say has a great impact on what Representative Holby's concern is about at what level do we establish high wages to the extent that we have lost much of our manufacturing base, which, Graham, I think, and again, correct me, jump in here, but I think oftentimes pays 35% over what many other service sector jobs and those sorts of things that pay, that that we have hopefully not intentionally allowed a ratcheting down of what may be a high wage economy. And I think yesterday's presentation in part showed that there are alternatives, that we do have emerging industries, that we do have emerging sectors and clusters that offer the hope of retaining our manufacturing base, of offering extremely high wage jobs, jobs that I think would challenge the average worker, and to not only be productive but challenge their intellect. And one of the things that I took home from yesterday's discussion is that, to Representative Barnhart's point that he made yesterday, oftentimes as a state we have allowed, again, not intentionally, but as our economy has changed and different factors have changed, we have allowed challenges now to exist to the further development of this industry. And he talked at length about our land use planning laws and how we may need to change areas that are zoned in our state that would be ideal locations for these very large placements of energy solar collectors. And the zoning right now perhaps is an impediment to siting those. But one of the things that we can do as government is to facilitate those kinds of changes to allow these new businesses and these new sectors and these new clusters to grow so that we can continue to enjoy the very kind of manufacturing that you're appropriately concerned about, and the kinds of wages that Representative Holby is appropriately concerned about, and I think which all of us on this committee are striving for in terms of workforce and economic development.
So, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please, Vice Chair.
So, with the facts in, so we need to find the answer, which directions we need to in the future. I don't see any clear picture where we are going. And the labor-intensive industry, it goes all offshore, such as China, their gross incomes per year is less than 1,000, and ours is 30, 40, 50, even more. And then even though we don't have any clear picture, somehow we need to find out the answer, how we are going to combat those things, either higher automation or something more that research and development to make sure we are the top and number one in creating new inventions, so continue to create more jobs. We need to find out the answer, otherwise the worldwide labor industry with more free trade agreement instead of fair trade, that worldwide they are going to bring down our age continually downwards. And that's my big concern.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Vice Chair Lim, and my good friend. And that I share completely your concerns, and I'm sure many of our other committee members do, and I'd like an opportunity to discuss that further, and will, but first, Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I missed the first part of your presentation. I was my presence was required at another committee, but thank you for doing this. And I just wanted to say, you know, I absolutely concur with Vice Chair Lim that we need to find the answer, and it's difficult for a state to find the answer to a global economy when we're kind of at the mercy of the federal government in many, many ways. And so we're not a country, we're a state, and we need to find ways that we can affect it and not be impacted by federal regulation any more than we have to. So I agree with you.
And Vice Chair Lim, to your point, and I think you are right on target. And I am one who's concerned that oftentimes I think more as a nation, as Vice Chair Riley has pointed out, than as a state, that we overlook perfectly good information that suggests trends to us that are extremely disturbing. Mm-hmm. Precisely what you're talking about. I can remember back in the mid-80s, Business Week came out with a special edition on the hollow corporation and the hollowing out of America's economy, and quite frankly laid out for us end-to-end how much of our manufacturing was being offshored, and I remain unconvinced that we adequately addressed the trends that that Business Week alerted our nation to. More recently, here I think about a year and a half ago now, same publication came out with a special edition on the century of China and India. And if this was not a wake-up call to us as a nation, I don't know what is. Because they weren't talking about the next year, the next decade. This was an entire century. It was going to focus on China and India. That suggests to me that if we continue on the same glide path, that we are soon not to be the greatest country in the world. And if that's true, then precisely what you and Representative Holby have talked about, the loss of our manufacturing capacity and the loss of an adequate income to maintain families in our state and in our nation are the end result of our allowing ourselves to be put in a position where we have become second rate. Now, what is it that we can do? And that's the question, Vice Chair Lim, that you have posed. And I would go back to our committee's report from last session. That said that fundamentally critical for us to remain globally competitive is for us to have an educated workforce that is surpassed by no country in this world. Now, that's easier said than done, obviously, and we've repeatedly run into challenges in our committee's discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then, by God's willing, when we come back next session, we know the what is going on, and we have the facts. I think the next session we need to find out the answer where we are going to do. Federal government is federal government.
Yes.
As a state, we need to find our answer, which directions we need to go. I think that's the crucial. 10 years later, we should have done that. I think we need to find the answer next session if possible.
Committee members, I suggest that Vice Chair Lim has just laid the challenge before this committee, and I, for one, Vice Chair, will commit to working with you to that end.
Thank you.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I totally agree with Vice Chair Lim and some of the comments that you've made too, and I just want to offer that I don't think yeah, I'm sure it's pretty apparent to us, but perhaps not, that it's probably not one solution. I think there are pieces of this puzzle that we can take and move forward to help solve this problem. You know, what are our niches? What are our advantages? And I think the Oregon Business Plan has reiterated some of those issues around traded sectors and some of the educational components as being two pieces of that puzzle. And certainly, I think if we try to take a bite and look for some incremental solutions to this problem and just start working on those incremental pieces, that the more of those pieces we put together, the better our solution will become.
And one of the things that that Patrick's going to do for the committee is he's going to resend out our committee's report from last session, because it talked about many of these issues. It talked about the need for a highly educated workforce. It talked about the need for us to engage in the traded sector, because, frankly, that's how we gain. It talked about the need for us to look at some very specific industries and cluster development so that we can maximize some of our existing competitive advantages. Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add one more thing. I don't mean to pontificate on an old subject, but I just want to remind us that, you know, in previous informational hearings that you've had, all of which are great, you know, I think that we also have this culture in industry and business that really needs to make a commitment to having job opportunities for trainees, for interns, for apprentices. You know, we need to have our industry stepping forward with those on-the-job training opportunities, because if they're not there, we're not going to meet the demand. Education is a big piece, but you have to have those job opportunities to follow up with that education.
That that practicum component is absolutely critical. Absolutely critical. Additional questions or comments? Graham, I think you've elicited a great conversation. And once again, Vice Chair Lim, look forward to working with you this next session. And I think, as I say, you've laid down a perfect challenge for this committee. I'm very fortunate to have you once again, Graham. Thank you so much. Let's see. Patrick, would you give us a brief rundown on what we can expect here tomorrow?
Oh, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Governor's Education Advisor, Jim Sager, will be joining us tomorrow to a follow-up. He had indicated he was going to do some follow-up information on Audrey Tice's presentation from last week. That's on tap for tomorrow. And then Thursday, what we currently have planned for Thursday is a presentation from Economic and Community Development Department, which they that incorporates some of the some budget note follow-ups that they just recently presented to Ways and Means Committee, and thought that this committee needed to know. We had to wait until after Ways and Means heard it, since Ways and Means had requested it. So, but we're going to hear that on Thursday.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Vice Chair Lim.
If we have time, I'm interested in hearing from the lottery department what they are doing. And so that's almost 10% of their general funds almost.
Yes.
And at least I haven't heard from them at all.
Yes.
I'd like to know what's going on.
And that's an area, Vice Chair Lim, that I'd like to hear about as well. We may not be able to do it here because our committee's informational session is done after Thursday, is it, Patrick?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that most of the committees will close after their meetings on Thursday.
Okay.
With the exception of the Rules Committees, the Revenue Committees, and Ways and Means.
Okay. But we,
Mr. Chair,
please, Vice Chair Riley.
Is that true for informational hearings as well? Because we are an interim committee, and we could continue as an interim committee. In my opinion, I just want to know what the rules are at this point.
Thank you. I Mr. Chair, I have conferred informally with other administrators in my office, and it's our understanding at this point that committees will not be meeting after Thursday, even for informational meetings. Now, that being said, that's our current understanding, and everything, of course, is subject to change. So I will check into that to see if it's possible to meet after.
And I'll check with the speaker.
Great. Sounds good. And we will have opportunities, I'm sure, Vice Chair Lim, to have interim meetings as well, which that would be a perfect subject. I would just like to say that our committee's discussion here this morning, you've made my day, committee members. Thank you so much. And your commitment to good jobs and to sound business and to a robust economic climate, both for our state and our country, makes my heart warm. Thank you for this discussion. Thank you for your commitment. And folks who want to do the right thing and who are inclined to keep moving this agenda are able to make progress. And I look forward to that kind of progress on this committee. Thank you for your support in that regard. And with that, I will adjourn today's meeting.